Welcome back to the Dobbies podcast. This episode is about caring for the National Trust for Scotland's heritage gardens. I'm Louise Midgley and I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest, Anne Steele, Head of Heritage Gardening at the National Trust for Scotland. We are going to be talking about how the conservation gardens are cared for, what sustainable products are used, and how they are maintained to keep them in perfect condition for wildlife and visitors to enjoy. Hello Anne, thank you for joining me today.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Scotland's conservation charity, National Trust for Scotland, plays a key role in maintaining and protecting almost 100 important sites. From Glencoe to St Kilda, Craigievar Castle to Culloden, and Inverurie to Branklin Garden. These special places mean so much to so many of us, and it's a wonderful time of the year to be visiting them. The Trust manages 38 beautiful gardens and design landscapes, which provide tranquil places that are so beneficial for the body and soul, and will be giving us an insight into what goes into their upkeep and preservation, and will tell us how we can all help the conservation charity maintain and protect these treasures. So Anne, perhaps we could start by you telling us a little bit about your role at the National Trust for Scotland and the fantastic work the conservation charity carries out.
I'm head of policy and strategy for the Trust's gardens. So yeah, I spend quite a lot of time behind the desk coming up with plans for the gardens as a whole. But I'm also head of specialism for the Trust gardens and the Trust gardeners. So I need to know quite a lot about a lot of different things. Yeah, I mean, we've got an amazing set of gardeners out there working in our gardens all the time. So I'm really privileged to work with them.
It's a very varied job, isn't it? You've got so many sort of hats to wear there, haven't you?
Yes. Yes, gardening is, it can seem like a simple thing in some ways. You can have some quite simple gardens, but we've got some very complicated gardens as well with a lot of history. So lots of elements to think about all the time.
Absolutely. And have you always been passionate about gardening? Did that inspire your career choice?
Well, I guess having worked for the Trust for about 30 years now, I guess it's safe to say that I'm pretty passionate about gardens and gardening and so on. But, you know, and even after all this time, I still love plants and you know, all the different elements of horticulture. But in terms of where I started, I guess I've got a lot of crofting and farming, you know, further back in my family. My own parents were teachers, though. So for me, there was a bit of a crunch point when I was about to go to university and study law. And I sort of took a step back and thought, I really don't want to do this. I want to be outside. And so I had a bit of a think. And then I went to work for the Trust as a volunteer. And I guess the rest is history, really, for me.
Probably one of the best decisions you made. Because if you know, you
Absolutely.
Would have been completely stuck behind a desk, I suppose, unless you'd gone into being in court. But yes, it's such an amazing, I love to be outside. It's you know, my whole life is about being outside.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, an interest in gardening starts as just at being an interest, you know, in being outdoors and different elements of being outdoors. And then suddenly they think, this is something I can do outdoors all the time.
And maybe you could just give us a little bit of an idea about your working, how your working day evolves at the Trust. I'm sure you have a wide variety of different roles because they're all needed to maintain all the different gardens. But sort of what does an average day entail?
I'd say for me these days, there's a lot of desk work, but I've always got an excuse to go out and visit a garden, which is really rather nice. As an example, even today, I'll be doing a piece of work on the Trust's corporate strategy. So that sounds a little bit dry, but it's, you know, it's about the direction of the organisation as a whole and making sure that gardens feeds into that. But then the other thing I'll be doing today is helping, well, not just helping, but devising an induction programme for our new garden apprentices. We have just sort of gone through a recruitment process. So making sure that they get a good start, not just in the Trust, but in their careers in horticulture. So very varied. No 2 days are alike. Absolutely the case.
That's what's so lovely, isn't it? So you've always got some sort of new challenge to work on. And the National Trust Scotland Gardens vary from property to property. So how do the gardening teams take care of the different landscapes?
Well, that's where we really rely on the skills of the gardeners. They need to absolutely understand their places and what's involved in them. So, you know, for some of them, it can be what might look like a fairly simple landscape, you know, a designed landscape that's lots of, you know, open space and trees and so and sort of maybe some kind of built features in the landscape. And there, you know, there'll very much be a focus on, you know, the care of those trees, succession planting, making sure, you know, that landscape will continue on into the future. But then we get at the opposite end of the scale, we can have really intense gardens that are, you know, quite small, all about the plants, all about the detail. And they're a really close attention to making sure things are, you know, weeded and even the sort of dead flowers taken off the plants when they finish flowering. So really varied.
Really varied. So So many different places to see. There's one garden that I really want to go to. It's Branklin Garden in Perth.
I think that's the one I had in mind. Yes.
Oh, did you?
I was talking about the detail. Yes.
I was just thinking that because I think they have the National Plant Collection for Mechanopsis and I really want to see those beautiful blue poppies. I think maybe late spring, is it? Sometime like that?
Yes. And even into kind of earlier summer, you know, earlier into the summer, so kind of June time or something is a good time. And that's, you know, that's a prime example of a garden where it really is absolutely all about the details, making sure things are all labelled correctly because they're all in quite a small space, you know, so you need to make sure that they don't grow into each other and that each one is distinct. Also, when it comes to something like the Mechanopsis, when you've got things on the face of it that look quite similar in the same space or in the same garden, you need to make sure that they're planted in different areas so we can kind of keep track of them and make sure that they're not kind of hybridising and the collection is as sort of managed as it can be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But it sounds like it's a place that's just stuffed with beautiful plants. And a lot of it's come from plant collectors in the past. So I just really want to go there.
It's a beautiful garden. And it's got that real sense of history as well, because it was designed by a couple who were really into their plants, into rock gardens in particular, rock plants, alpines, plants from the Himalayas that were kind of coming in at that time. So this was the Rentons. And they left us with amazing records of what they planted and where they put it and so on. So we can refer back.
Oh, that's so beneficial, isn't it? Yes. Oh, fantastic. We can't grow blue poppies where I live, so to see them. I have seen them down here in certain gardens. I think they need a lot of peat, don't they? Acid sort of conditions.
They do certainly prefer acid conditions, but we're obviously, as an organisation, we're not using peat anymore. So that's a challenge.
No, I mean in the ground. Yes, yeah.
Yes.
Natural peat.
But in an artificial, you know, if you think of a garden like Branklin, it's quite an artificial sort of situation. So some people would think you might want to add peat, but we certainly wouldn't be doing that. But yes, they do. They like that kind of, you know, kind of fairly open soil like that. So leaf mould, you know, they'll use leaf mould or something sort of similar to give them the conditions that they like.
I'll get there sometime soon.
Yeah, well worth a visit.
And Anne, I understand the Truss Gardens represent almost every style of Scottish gardens throughout history. Perhaps you could give us an idea of the variations amongst them.
I mean, we have certainly a representation of different periods of history, but some we have created ourselves. So in a sense, one of our oldest looking gardens would be Kouros Palace, where we've created a medieval garden behind the palace there. But that's our creation, our sense of what the garden looked like. The garden itself was only created in the 1990s, you know, so it's quite an interesting thing to have done, quite an interesting project, a lovely little garden, I'm really fond of it. But then we have gardens that are kind of, you know, have genuine layers and layers of history, and that'd be places like Crathas Castle or Killane Castle, you know, where you've got grand design landscapes. In the case of Killane, you know, the influence of Robert Adam, the designer, as well. So we have that sort of garden. But then we come right up to date with things like the garden round about the Hill House, which had some influence from Charles Rennie Mackintosh. So that's at the beginning of last century, 1905. Right about then, the garden was built. But even more recently, like at Greenbank Garden in Glasgow, where the garden itself, the designed landscape itself, dates from sort of 1772, but then we've set it up as a sort of much more modern collection of plants. We try to use that kind of as a demonstration garden for today's gardeners.
I think the Greenbank Garden has got the plant heritage collection of begonias, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Another nice place I'd like to go.
Yeah. No, it's packed full of plants, Greenbank. It's a walled garden sitting within a designed landscape in a suburb of Glasgow. But because we have the designed landscape round about it, it feels like you're kind of out in the countryside. It's quite nice, quite a quiet place.
An incredible range of horticultural diversity between all those gardens. That's amazing. And do you have a favourite garden in the Trust that you love to visit?
I guess it's like asking somebody to pick their favourite child. I'm not really allowed to do that, I don't think. But obviously, having started out myself in Inverview Garden, which is a West Coast woodland garden, and having spent time working at Ardooney Garden as well, and for quite a long time working with gardens in the west of Scotland, you know, I find it hard to see past, you know, the beauty of, you know, the rhododendrons, you know, the diversity that we have there. And you mentioned the Mechanopsis, but all those kind of plants that love the West Coast that come from China and Chile and so on. I'll always have a soft spot for those gardens, I have to say.
And the weather can be very kind on the West Coast, can't it?
It can be kind, yes. You have to watch out a little bit for the midges, you know, so you can kind of keep moving, don't linger. Yeah. The West Coast of Scotland, it generally benefits from the sort of North Atlantic drift, so it is a bit milder. So you will see plants in those gardens that you would probably more expect to see in a garden in Cornwall.
And they wouldn't be going so well on the East Coast, would they?
No, definitely struggle, some of them.
So I think one of the reasons I love gardening so much is because one day is never the same as the next. You mentioned that earlier. What do you like most when you're out gardening?
Ah, well, I have suburban garden myself, where I mostly grow sort of shrubs and plants kind of within circles in the grass, as it were, because then my husband will mow the grass and I get to do the fun part of looking after the plants. So I quite like that.
Island beds. I love island beds.
Yes, I know. It's just been pragmatic with the amount of time that I have, really, I think. But I also have an allotment as well, and that's quite nice for me. I like going down to the allotment because it feels quite relaxed down there, you know, because everybody's gardening at a kind of at a more relaxed pace, I guess. So it's quite nice, and you get a bit of chat and so on. So, yeah, so I do like growing fruit and vegetables.
Well, there's just nothing like the taste, is there? I'm addicted to it. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about sustainable gardening and which sustainable products the teams use.
I was mentioning earlier on that not that long ago, we finally came down to saying we weren't going to use peat in any of our own homegrown plants. In fact, we've been doing that for quite a long time, but you know, we've now got a policy that says we won't do that. Our challenge, obviously, as it will be for any organisation, is getting plants that don't have peat in them. You know, obviously, the whole industry is, you know, struggling to find alternatives to peat in terms of growing. But we're moving as fast as we can in that direction. But also, you know, each of our gardeners are looking very closely at what they can do on their sites. So whether it's, you know, shifting to pots that can be recycled, as you know, there's kind of that change in colour. They've now gone to that kind of taupe colour instead of black, makes them kind of recyclable. And even for the gardens that are sort of productive gardens that are using sort of punnets for fruit and so on, they're making sure that these things, you know, can be recycled. But on a larger scale, I'm thinking now of Crathis Castle. We have one of our garden apprentices working up there is looking at a project to see just how many adaptations they can make up there to what they're doing right the way through the glass, you know, how they manage the water and so on, to be as sustainable as possible and reduce our carbon footprint. So it's something that our gardeners are looking at in a lot of detail, but it sort of varies from site to site exactly which products they might use.
And I think people nowadays are so well informed that they're demanding peat-free compost. And I know Dobby's launched its own range of peat-free compost with added John Innes, but I think it was gratefully received by the public because they do know that it's right to use and not right to use peat anymore.
I think so, and I think, you know, they also need our help. I think so, or the help of the industry. So when organisations like Dobby's, you know, clearly have it on the bags, you know, saying what's in, you know, what's the product is and the fact that it's peat free. Otherwise, gardeners, you know, unless they're told, they don't really know. They won't really know whether John Innes has peat in it or not or something. They just go and buy the compost and they'll be quite attached to the brands that they've used before, or not just the brands, but you know, the types of mixes they've used before. So they sometimes need a little bit of help, I think, and encouragement to shift to a peat free sort of model. But then in a sense, if we can do it, you know, I mean, I know we're kind of professionals, but if we, you know, if we can make that step and we're doing this all the time and we're, you know, still producing beautiful gardens and you know, plants for sale and so on, then hopefully that'll encourage other people to see that they can do it as well.
And the media is really doing their job because it's written about all the time in magazines and newspaper and on Gardener's World, on television programmes all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a challenge for the industry with the raw materials to make the products, I think. I think the more that people demand the products in the end of the day, the more pressure there will be on industry to kind of produce the compost, and you know that, and on the sort of supplying industry sitting in behind that, you know, that produces the bark, chips and so on, to, you know, to divert some of the supply towards compost.
And Anne, when it comes to looking after the rare plants and gardening sympathetically for insects, birds and mammals, what measures does the trust have in place for that?
So we're quite fortunate as an organisation because we have the garden side of things, but we also have a natural heritage side. So we kind of work in partnership over these sorts of elements. So our gardeners themselves are, you know, much more aware these days of the role of kind of biodiversity, you know, in the garden, in terms of yeah, you know, encouraging insects and pollinators and so on. So, you know, we've got a project up at InverU, you know, which is studying how bees are using the garden and which flowers they're visiting and how, you know, how long they sit on in particular flowers. So that's quite interesting. And we're looking forward to finding out more about that. But lots of gardeners, they'll leave some, you know, they may have bug hotels, you know, or they'll leave areas of the garden for insects to, you know, hibernate in. And yeah, in terms of the rare plants, I mean, as I say, we work with our natural heritage team, so that helps look after some of the rarer plants in our wider environment. But within the gardens, actually, we also have a role in terms of global conservation, in a sense. So plants that are rare elsewhere in the world, we have, you know, some of those growing in our gardens as well. So we're looking after those as part of a kind of wider initiative, I guess.
I think what I love to see about, you know, and I know I'm in England and it's not the same area, but what I love to see in the gardens down here is that so many places don't mow all the gardens all the time. So they're leaving great areas unmown, and maybe they have a mown path right through the middle so you can walk through, and wildflowers are naturalizing in that grass. And then, you know, that's really drawing in the little mammals, birds to have the seed heads, and masses of butterflies and insects. It's just so brilliant to see, and such an easy thing to do as well.
Yes, so we've certainly done quite a bit of that in the last year or so, and seeing kind of how it goes down with visitors as well, because they're used to a kind of a manicured lawn, which could also be considered a green desert, you know. So
yeah,
you know,
it's a monoculture, isn't it, really? Exactly.
Yeah, so I think what we're trying to be mindful of is the right place to do that. So areas you know, which are heavily used, you know, or we might use them for events and so on, but we would try and probably not choose to do it there. Or if we have a kind of something that's very much a fine lawn, like at Caratis we've got an old croquet lawn, for example, and it is still used for croquet, so that wouldn't be appropriate. But there are definitely other areas where, you know, we can let the grass grow longer. But we also probably want to make a change, so it's not just for us a matter of letting the grass grow longer, because as you'll appreciate, if the soil is quite rich, the grass will be long and can get quite rank, and you probably won't get the wildflowers. In some places like Millennia Garden, we have been sowing yellow rattle over the lawn, which helps to kind of reduce the fertility of the soil, so that you get the more delicate, attractive wildflowers coming up.
Yeah, that's perfect. So it just takes time, doesn't it? You just have to wait for that yellow rattle to grow and then to self-seed and to colonise the area.
Yes, gardening is, it is a long game.
It's an ever-changing game. And, you know, when you look at a landscape, for example, and you see trees that are in it, they change over the, you know, 5 or 10 years. They grow bigger and they change shape. It's ever-changing. It's wonderful to see. Could you tell us more about the different job roles and opportunities at the Trust and how members of the public can get involved in gardening with a conservation charity?
In terms of job roles, we have a range of jobs. We sort of have, for our sort of professionals, we have kind of start at a sort of seasonal gardener, assistant gardener level, and move right up through gardener specialists, head gardeners, gardens managers, and then there's my role as well. So a wide variety of roles. And in terms of people wanting to move into the profession, obviously we have our apprenticeships programme, which I was mentioning earlier. And we also, for people who've done a bit of horticultural training, we have a School of Heritage Gardening at Threave, which is in Dumfries and Galloway. In terms of people just wanting to get a taste of horticulture, we have a lot of garden volunteers and they're really welcome in our gardens. And that can give people, say, just a taste of it as a profession, or just, it's just a nice way to spend time and, you know, make new friends and so on. So we have groups of very loyal volunteers, you know, who've come to our gardens for years, regularly, once a week. And we can have up to sort of 50, 60 volunteers helping, you know, per property. So that's really useful to us. And as I say, people get a lot out of it as well. They get to work with each other. They get to do things in the garden, get to enjoy the garden, and they get the kind of advice and tips from the head gardener and the rest of the team as well. And then we also do, you know, quite a bit with schools. There's school visits. And in some cases, we actually have nurseries that operate in the garden, or like woodland nurseries, or sometimes, you know, local nurseries just make use of it as a facility. So there's a whole heap of ways that people can get involved.
Well, it's fantastic for little children to spark their imagination when they're young. Yeah, wonderful. And, you know, the volunteer gardeners, I think that's just amazing because we also have a lot of that down here. And it's a very social thing to do. And also you're increasing your skill set all the time. And, you know, you've got to focus. You've got somewhere to go if you're on your own or, you know, maybe you're retired and you're a bit lonely. It's something to do each week and that you really love, you know, being in a beautiful environment like that.
And it's so helpful for us as well in more ways than you might imagine. So it's not just about, you know, helping to do the tasks or you know, improve something that we might not have time to get round to. I was at, I mentioned Millennia beside Edinburgh. I was there the other week and I was so happy to see the volunteers were working, helping to kind of repair the edge of a roadway. And they were chatting to the visitors, you know, so in a sense the head gardener was off doing something with me and they were kind of, you know, being ambassadors for the trust and chatting about how much they were enjoying it. And it was just lovely to see.
Well, I'm sure they had loads to say and loads of information. So lovely. And what about, Anne, some useful gardening tips for the autumnal months that are lots of things that we've got to do in our gardens at the moment? What would you suggest?
Okay, I think for me, one of the things is if you think back sort of kind of critically over the kind of gardening season and what's gone well and what hasn't gone well, you know, sometimes you'll find that, you know, your border looked great at some point and then it sort of kind of went off. There was gaps or something. And if you can be organized enough about it, you know, to kind of think back about that, think when the gaps were and, you know, think about how you might address that. And, you know, one option that I certainly have found is quite good is, so if you've got a gap in May, make sure, put in your diary for next year that you're going to visit a garden or a garden centre in May. What looks good then? I think, right, I could have that in my garden and put it in your garden next year. So it calls for a little bit of long-term planning, but I think that's quite a useful one. Yeah, and just thinking about, you know, what plants in your garden maybe need sort of dividing come autumn, because once the leaves are off them, it's harder to remember where they were and where you wanted to put them. So it's a little bit of planning, I would say, and a bit of activity as well.
And the autumn is the best time to dig things up or put, you know, or plant things, because the soil is quite warm and you know you're going to get moisture over the next few months. It's better than putting them in late spring when you could have a hot summer and then they all dry up. So it's a great time to plant new plants.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, bulbs as well. Get your bulbs in at that time.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, so much to do. And I expect the one practical thing listeners can do if they want the National Trust for Scotland to continue to care and protect so many iconic places is to support them by becoming a member of the Trust.
Absolutely. Please visit, please become a member. You know, this charity is looking after all these special places, but we do really need support to do that.
Thank you so much for such an enlightening chat. I've loved hearing about how the Trust cares for Scotland's heritage gardens.
Well, it's been lovely speaking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
But that's all we have time for today. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to visit the National Trust for Scotland's website and follow them on social media to find out more about their fantastic properties to visit. And please go to www.dobbies.com for more podcasts, advice and gardening inspiration. And stay tuned for the next podcast, which is coming soon.